Hello, motion picture brains. That's you. Fans of light, darkness, composition, celluloid, zeros, and ones. Welcome to the second ever episode of the Through the Lens podcast. The unedited audio of our full conversation with one of the world's most dynamic cinematographers. In this episode, we spoke with the infectious Reed Murano, known for, amongst other things, the films of Frozen River, The Magic of Belle Isle, Shut Up and Play the Hits, and the soon-to-be-released Kill Your Darlings. What follows is the uncut audio of my conversation with Reed. We met in New York City at the offices of Handheld Films in October of 2012. Handheld Films, you guys are on awesome. If you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, and I don't know why you would, you will find it at crafttrek.com as Season 1, Episode 2 of Through the Lens, or youtube.com/crafttrek. You can also subscribe if you're feeling a little nutty. It should be noted that during this interview, Reed shapeshifted into a deer.
As I was saying, I looked at your resume, and it just looks like, you know, you did a few small things and bam, you just start shooting. Is that...
Yeah, I mean, I basically focused on shooting in college. I don't think I could have done it if I hadn't gone to film school, because when I came out of film school, I had a reel. It was not a good one, but I had shot enough stuff that I had the confidence to go out and try to get... no one really told me how to do it, and I didn't really train under other DPs except for in college. I was a focus puller for this DP named Fred Manu, and he was like this Frenchman, very debonair, and he knew what I thought was everything about lighting. And I was just, he had a very minimal crew, which was basically him and me, and he was shooting his senior thesis. And
you remember the debonair part, of course.
I had like, you know, stars in my eyes about him and everything. But he militantly trained me as an AC. He would time me loading and unloading mags, and you know, if I didn't get in a certain amount of time.
Loading mags has got to be the most...
It's annoying.
Like nerve-wracking thing in the planet. Like,
I was definitely scared, but more nerve-wracking than loading mags, I think. I mean, at the level you're at when you're loading mags, that is the most nerve-wracking thing in the planet.
Yeah.
But then when you move up and you start pulling focus, that's actually...
Way more
That's, to me, actually is the hardest job on set, because it's like... Maybe not now, where you can see digital.
Performance can be great. Lighting can be perfect.
Right.
The operator can nail the motion of the shot. Everything can be there. The director can be thrilled with the action.
So many things have to align.
And you fucked up by 1 inch, and it's out.
Yeah.
It's done.
It's rough. So I just quickly learned I did not want to do that for a living. Like, I enjoyed it, and I learned a lot from him when I did it for him, and I did it for some other people. And then after college, I basically started working in Genie, and I was working...
In the beginning, did you know you wanted to be a DP, like as a cinematographer?
Oh, yeah, because what happened was I didn't know what I wanted to do when I went to college. I just thought, because I wrote stories a lot growing up, and I was more of like I was more of that side of it. I was not a technical person at all. I was just like some nerdy girl who wrote stories a lot. And then eventually my dad brought home... One of those, like, first video cameras was, like, a JVC, one of those gigantic ones.
Oh, yeah.
That had literally, like,
with
the
tape
VHS
in it. You could put a tape right into it.
Yeah. It was, like, either a Betamax or it was, like, a VHS. It was one of the first ones that you could have at home, so it was probably a VHS tape. And he forced it on me, basically. I didn't want to do it. And he was, like, you're gonna take care of shooting the family. And I was like, okay. And he showed me how to, like, turn it on and how to, like, fade in and fade out, because obviously that was, like, a special feature of the first video cameras.
Look at this. It goes to I can make it go to black or white.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
How does that
Depending
work?
Depending on the emotion of the scene.
Yeah, you know, right.
The emotional, you know, value of what was going on. So he showed me how to do that, and then I didn't really want to do it, but eventually I realized I actually liked it, and I started just subconsciously I liked it. I didn't, like... You know, consciously know I liked it. I would pick it up all the time when I was bored, and I would shoot. There's like hours and hours of footage of just like the nature outside my house in Long Island, which is not a lot of nature, and it was super boring. And then there's some footage that's really entertaining that's like commercials that I made up with my little brother, who's 3 years younger than me, and he was the subject. And like, you know, he's in the shower doing commercials for Germac shampoo, you know, because it's like the 80s.
How old are you at this point?
I was like third grade or fourth grade or
so
fifth
you're like 13
grade. No, actually,
or 14.
The commercials came between
second grade, seven, eight, nine.
No, you know what? like, I started in second grade when we lived in New Mexico.
Eight.
Yeah, I started shooting in New Mexico because that's when he first brought it to me. And we were shooting at his house, and I was, like, sort of setting up scenes, almost like soap opera type things. And then when I was, like, I started doing the commercials when I was in sixth grade, actually, when I lived in Long Island.
Okay, so now you're maybe 11, 12. Yeah. No, yeah, 13. Coming up to 12, 13.
Yeah, so my brother, like, opened the shower door and a towel wrapped around him, and he was, like, 9. And he'd hold up a thing of Germac shampoo and be like, Germac. And then he would, like, read the thing on the back that it says, you know, like, just make something up. And then
he'd drink it?
And then, yeah. He did something for Fantastic, the all-purpose cleaner is what he said, because he was, like, reading it and didn't know so there's, like, some really funny things that we
did. That's beautiful.
And music videos with the kids I even did later when I was older.
So you knew you wanted to be a shooter.
I didn't know that at that point. I just did it because I was bored. And then when I went when I started to figure out, like, okay, I got to apply to college and everything, I didn't know what I wanted to do because I wrote a lot. And I did photography in high school. I was, like, the head of photography on the yearbook and the newspaper and everything. But I wasn't really sure.
What were you shooting on in high school?
Just like 35 millimeter SLR.
You had a Nikon or something like that? Or
yeah, it was like a Canon, I think, or a Pentax, actually. My parents had an old Pentax that I was using.
So when you go back and you look at those photos, if you were to go back and look, you know, here's for the high school yearbook, here's for the football game or whatever, do you see, like, composition? Do you see, like, I mean, do you see things that you go, oh,
yeah.
What do you see in those photos that, you know, I mean, analyzing the artist that you are? I'm just asking.
I don't see it like, you know, I think at that point it was more about storytelling for me, which is really the point at the end of the day. What I do now is more about, is equally about storytelling and about making the composition and the lighting. Yeah. But at that point, I think I was just more of being a storyteller. And I do think in the photographs more than in the video footage, but in the photographs I actually... It was about, there was a lot of subtle sort of, you know, hints that there might have been some level of composition. You know what I mean? Like,
talent.
Very, very
it's
subtle.
Okay, we can use the word talent.
Maybe. I don't, you know, I wouldn't go that far. But I would say that, like, the people were happy to let me use, I shot a lot of close-ups of students in high school and stuff like that, and I felt like they looked pretty. You know what I mean? Like, they looked different. They weren't the standard medium shot that, you know, you're seeing.
With the head right in the center of the frame and
right.
That much headroom and everything like that.
Yeah, there was definitely, like, a little
something
more of a, yeah. And so basically at that point when I decided to apply to college, I applied to only 4 schools, and one was film school at NYU. And it was more like my dad saying, well, it makes sense. You should go to film school because you were a writer. All you did was write stories, and now you like to take photographs. So if you combine those two things, you know, why don't you make movies? And he really wanted me to make movies because he wanted to make movies with me. So
your dad.
My dad did. But he ended up passing away in my freshman year of college.
Right here.
But, yeah, it was like he had a heart attack. He was only 46, and... Yeah, it was kind of a totally sudden thing. But basically, actually, the interesting thing about what happened is that he sort of pushed me to go to film school. He didn't push me. He just came up with the idea. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's a good idea. And when I got into NYU, I was just like, forget all these other schools. I'm going to go to film school.
That sounds like the bomb.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. So I went to film school, and the very first shoot I worked on was somebody's color sync film or, you know, maybe, yeah, it was like a color sync film, which is like the third year level, you know, film where... They're shooting 16 usually.
Yeah.
They have sync sound and all this. And
who are your professors there? Any professors that you remember? Because you know, they usually bring in a guest.
Yeah. Michael Carmine is like the one that I'm still really in touch with. He was my sort of cinematography mentor. Basically. Yeah.
What were the things that you picked up, right? You know, that you have a firm memory of him saying, look, Reed, this is, you know, this. Here's some things that you got to keep in mind. About.
Sort of. I mean, I didn't pay attention. Basically, what I was going to say is that on that first shoot is when I just started noticing the DP as a position.
Ah, okay.
Like, I didn't even really think about it as a job option, to be honest. And then I noticed camera, cinematography-wise, I noticed, like, well, first I'll tell you the rest of that. So basically on that shoot, I was like, whatever that guy's doing, that's what I want to do. Because he's the one who has his eye on the viewfinder. I want to be the first person to look.
I want to be the one looking through this.
Like, I'm kind of a, I wouldn't say I'm a control freak. You actually kind of have to be slight, you have to be like a weird type of control freak to be a DP, I think, because you're a control freak over what you should, but you have to know that it's actually not for you, it's for someone else. So you have to make what they want, but you, as long as you can control every...
You're a subservient master.
Yeah, exactly. So I was basically like, I want to do that job. I want to be the first person to see the shot before everyone else. And now maybe I want to be... I want everyone else to see how I saw it through my eyes. So, and I was also like fascinated by the light meter and the lights, and I didn't know what an apple box was, and I just wanted to know why they were measuring to the camera. It was like all these things that were totally unfamiliar to me. And I decided in that weekend that I, on that shoot, that I wanted to be a DP. And then when I went back to my dorm room, that's when I found out that my dad had a heart attack. And I went up to New Hampshire to see him. He was in a coma, and I got to be with him when he passed away. But I thought it was interesting that that same weekend is the weekend where I really, like, I literally made up my mind, and I've always been kind of wishy-washy, like, up until that point. And then when I made up my mind, I never changed it. So I basically decided, okay, I'm going to be, I want to learn how to be a DP. So I asked all the older students at school, what do I do? And they were like, just tell every other student that you want to shoot their films, and that, you know, most people at NYU want to be directors anyway, so...
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. You know, and they'll let you shoot their films and then take every technical class and you'll be indispensable by the time you graduate. And so that's what I did. And, you know, I was one of a handful of the DPs in our year. And then, you know, Mike Carmine, who is like a mentor to me, he basically, he, I think, had some, you know, he had a lot of faith in me. So he basically was always kind of pumping me up and, you know, making me feel like, just because I was the only girl in the class at that time, you know, was in his, in the, there was other girls in my year who were trying to be cinematographers as well, but, you know, there was just, like, three of us or two of us.
Yeah. I asked Amy Vincent the same question, and she had her take on it, and, you know, we're supposed to meet with Antlin Corus eventually, and, you know, great photographers, you know. Why is it that there are so, why it's such a heavily male-dominated field? Not dominated, but just proportionally. It's more, so many more men than women.
I mean, I think it's just, you're the head. I think that it started out as a more, all of Hollywood back in the day was more of a boys' club.
Yeah, except for script supervisor. It was,
yeah.
They thought it was a glorified sec. They used to call that the script girl.
Yeah.
That was literally like the credit was script girl, you know.
Yeah.
Really? You know, yeah. But anyway, so go ahead. You were saying, yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying. I think that that's where it comes from, and I think also just the fact that you're in charge of a crew that's also predominantly male. You're the person who's giving them the direct orders of what to do with very technical gear. Because at the same time, being a cinematographer, I'm sure lots of I am not particularly a technical cinematographer, but I do. I know if you asked me what light I wanted where, I could tell you. But I sometimes I micromanage and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'll say, well, let's put the 6K outside that window, you know, with light grid in front of it. But sometimes I'll just be like, can I have a nice light. Daylight push coming in, and I want it kind of medium soft, you know. But it just depends on who I'm working with and how much they need, how much information I think would be helpful to them. You know?
Right, I get it. So, I mean, that's a very elegant answer to that question. You're just saying, you know, it's tradition, it's old habits die hard. You know?
Yeah, I think it's hard to break people out of that idea that, we, you know, it's putting a woman in charge of, like, an army of people, and also it's based in very technical gear, cameras and lights and all the grip gear and rigging and things like that that normally people would not want to put in the hands of a woman.
Right.
But what they don't realize, actually, is cinematography is a lot more... While, yes, you should know everything that you could know you should know how to work a camera. You should know how to put up lights. You should have done all those jobs on the way up. But it's not just about that. It's actually about, like, intuition and taste. And it's about, like, you know, having an eye, which... You know, there's so many amazing female photographers in the world, and it's really just a different. It's instead of composing one frame at a time, you're composing 24 frames at once,
right.
And as the character's moving, sometimes the camera's moving, and so you're recomposing 24 frames per second. You know, like, and it's it's, while it's technical, it's still an art, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So it could be a man or a woman who does it. It doesn't really matter.
Well, no, there's no question here about whether it was more. It's more a function of, you know, why.
Why was it like that?
To me, you would think that, you know, first of all, let's assume that there's a lot more male directors than there are female directors.
Right.
You would think a lot of them would like a feminine voice when they turn to that camera for a balance to whatever they're, or a different perspective,
right,
for what they're thinking. And so that might think that, you know, there'd be a bigger pathway for women to get into this side of the business, but maybe things just take time sometimes.
I think it's changing. I mean, it's definitely changing, not super fast, but it's changing. Yeah. I know so many female, up-and-coming female cinematographers, besides the obvious, like, greats that are out there, like, you know, Ellen and Amy and Sandy and Nancy, and Maurice, you know, who are also amazing. There's, you know, all these girls who I know, women who I know who are around my age and just sort of same as me, trying to make making indie features, shooting commercials, and they're also talented. And it's really just a matter of time, I think, where it starts to balance out. It's just that I think women are starting to feel more empowered that they can do that job. And I do talk to a lot of younger women who are just starting out, like they've just gone to film school and they want to work as the DP on the shoot. They want to learn how to do that, but they feel intimidated by the guy. And it's really just something a lot of women females themselves have to get over. You just have to decide that you're going to do it and then have confidence in yourself and not be confident in like a cocky way. Just be, you know, sure that you can do it. Yeah, don't be like...
I'm serious. Just be confident like you. Like, we're sitting here right now and I'm thinking, you know, somebody said, you know, can read you, you know, 24 episodes of a huge TV show. I say, absolutely. She knows what she's doing. She's confident, right? It's just, you know, it's the question of, you know, confidence.
Yeah, you have to have confidence. And even... And I've also learned, too, that, you know, you have to ask questions. You have to try to just keep accumulating knowledge and don't be afraid. If you don't know how to do something but you think you can figure it out, say you know how to do it. If you do know how to do something, if you don't know how to do something and don't know how to figure it out, make sure you talk to someone before you get stuck in that scenario on set. It's things like that. It's like if someone asks you if you never lit a green screen before and someone asks you if you can light a green screen and you think you have the resources, you should say yeah. And then... get a gaffer who knows how to light a green screen.
Yeah, when do you want me to do that? 50 minutes? Just a second, I'm going outside for a cigarette. How do you light a green screen? The funny thing is that the technique you're talking about is actually pretty good. There's a fine line between...
You don't want to do it with, like, major shit. You just want to do it with, like, things that are, like, achievable. Things that you know you could probably do. Maybe you haven't necessarily done it yet, but you're like, yeah, I know, it has to be lit evenly, blah, 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 same stuff the whole way. Like, you know, like, the only way you're going to learn is by doing. So you have to just, you know, don't take a chance on some kind of huge, gigantic project that could ruin your life if you fuck it up, but make sure that, don't be afraid of everything. You just can't be afraid. You have to rise to the occasion. You have to rise to the challenge, whatever challenge is put in front of you. So, like, if you get asked to do a project and it's a way bigger budget than you're used to and maybe a way bigger talent or way bigger director, you should just be like, you know what, they asked me to do it, they believe in me, and like, I'm gonna fucking do it. You know, like, figure it out.
That's great advice. So let's just go. So you leave NYU and then you start shooting commercials, presumably, or music videos, usually music videos first, or short films?
Mostly short films. I didn't really get into music videos or commercials. I mostly did shorts. I mostly did narrative.
What are you doing for money at this point?
Right out of school?
Yeah.
I was working in G&E, like I was working as Grip and Electric, on the side of shooting things for free, because at that point no one was actually paying me to shoot stuff. I was actually just more happy to get a job shooting anything, and then I would shoot it for free. At the same time, I was doing a little bit of everything. I was waitressing, I was temping in a hedge fund, and I was also... working in G&E on indie features. So I started out as a G&E intern, and then I eventually worked my way up, and I started key gripping, which is sort of not the usual path for a DP, because usually they go up through lighting. Yeah, and I think it makes sense, actually. I guess my point is, like, I gravitated towards that, probably because it's more of a physical challenge.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of, like, okay, I'm going to just every day see if I can do this. Yeah. And then I realized that it was actually really good for lighting, because the whole point, it's not putting the light up, it's what you do with it once you get the light up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's how you position it, it's what you put in front of it, it's how you cut it.
Yeah. And you were gripping, that's interesting. And, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, a lot of people don't know that whereas there's, you know, only one path to directing, which is you start directing. Folks think of an assistant directing, so they get to an AD, really big AD, really high paid, really big first AD, mm-hmm. that's it. You know, not necessarily, like James McTeague made a jump to directing.
It's hard to do.
Whereas, you know, you can work up to being a producer through production management, can happen. I mean, you still need to produce sooner or later your own thing. You can work up to costume design through the wardrobe. You can work up to editing through the editorial department. But for photography, you can work up through electrics, through grip, or through camera.
Right.
And that's kind of the challenge of the DP, is to know all three of them. I want to talk a little bit about... Okay, so the movie that sort of puts you on the map as Reed Morano, cinematographer, is Frozen River, right?
Mm-hmm. That's,
okay. So you look at this movie, and it's one of these movies that was shot HD.
Yeah, we shot on the very cam.
So not even really, like, almost like second grade HD, right?
Yeah, it was pretty low grade.
And it's a movie that you're watching that, like, it at times it feels so candid that you feel like you're, you know, almost like on a home video mm-hmm. of right in the action. And then at times it feels completely cinematic. It feels, you know, and it all works together to sort of let the story unfold in a very interesting way. I mean, you got a Melissa Leo giving a phenomenal performance.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, who wouldn't have known she was going to win an Oscar, you know, like the same year, the year after. But it's so clear that she just did a phenomenal performance. But you have the story that's set in the Buffalo, Niagara region.
Mm-hmm.
How did the project come to you, and what, like, just tell us about getting on the show and what you wanted to do with it at first.
Well, I mean, there's a sort of me and the producer and I sort of think that I got it two different ways. Like, I think I applied to I had met with that producer previously for another feature, and that I didn't end up shooting, and he had my reel. And he claims he gave my reel to the director, to Courtney. And I think I actually applied to an ad on Craigslist and then reminded him that I existed, you know, because I actually remember applying to an ad on Craigslist crew gigs. So I, at that time, that's how I was finding projects that I was shooting. By that point, I had already been paid to shoot a lot of stuff. And I had been paid to shoot, you know, not well, just paid to shoot a couple features, and I had been paid to shoot many shorts, and I had been paid to shoot some TV stuff. But I was still, like, just struggling, you know. And at that point, I had done a documentary called Off the Grid Life on the Mesa, but right before Frozen River, before I got the script.
Well, that was for a brother-sister team, right?
Yep, Randy and Jeremy Stolberg. Yeah. And
right. That was at Sundance in, like, 2000.
It was at Slam Dance in 2007 or something, maybe 2006, 2007. So when I was there, and I was like, I really want to get something in Sundance. I had never had anything in Sundance, and I was just like, you know what I really need is I need, like, a really good drama that has sort of a known indie actor in it, maybe has something to do with Native Americans. And then, like, literally a month later, I got the script for Frozen River, or, like, even less than a month later, probably, like, 3 weeks later, the script for Frozen River came.
Why Native Americans?
Because there's, like, that cliche that if the movie had Native Americans in it, it would get into Sundance. So maybe don't put that in the interview. I mean, it's messed up to say that, but it's just funny that I wished for that, and then that's the exact thing that
happened.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is an extremely compelling story. Again, like, you know, if you watch the movie, first of all, the snow, it's the old mark about a story that's compelling. They hit the beats, either mm-hmm. you know, in some way or another, they hit the beats. Movie starts, you find out that she can't afford this house that her husband's gambling.
Right.
This new house away, and that it's being delivered and it's being taken away every time because she can't afford to pay it. And then the next thing that happens, trying to chase down her husband, she finds this opportunity in terms of human trafficking.
Right.
And we're off to the races. When you read it, did you go, yeah, this is a really well-structured script?
Like yeah, as soon as I read it, I was like this. I basically said to my boyfriend at the time, who was my gaffer, who's now my husband, Matt, I was like, this is going to get into Sundance. This might get into Sundance. That's what I said to him. I go, this is definitely the best script I've ever read that has been offered to me, and we have to do it. And then when we found out, like, you know, it was so tight, the budget, and nobody made any money. But I convinced, you know, a whole bunch of my friends to go up there to Plattsburgh, New York, and freeze their asses off for a whole month, and it sucked. But I knew that when I read that script, I was like, this movie could get into Sundance. And the highest hopes I had for it was that it would just get into Sundance. Not that it would win the Grand Jury Prize or maybe later be nominated for 7, you know, Independent Spirit Awards or maybe later be nominated for Academy Awards. I didn't think about that at all. I was just like, this movie is the story is so good. Like, how can you go wrong?
Right.
And that's really the point. That's really, like, if you read a script and you know, you'll know with the script, you know? It's hard to, if the script is that solid, it's hard to screw it up. I mean, we had nothing on that movie. And we were so rushed and, you know, kind of all odds against us from a technical standpoint, you know, with working with that camera and then, you know, we shooting in the snow and video.
Adam Arjouet, The Fast Runner, which is a Canadian film, it won the Camera d'Or at Cannes in, I think, 2003 or 2004. It was shot on DV, all Inuits in you know, the north, like all snow. And I watched the movie and I go, I can't make out what's going on. Like, I mean, you can, but it's very hard. So how did you deal? I mean, the camera you're talking about, still very much a video camera.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's technically HD, but still very much. How did you deal with the fact that there's so much stuff? Because your movie, you can see what's going on. You know, you don't get lost in the, I mean, there's a beautiful crane moment when she's driving onto the river for the first time and you crane all the way up and it looks just beautiful.
Yeah, that was a condor. But we can.
So in other words, what you're saying is we cut into the shot after the start again.
Yeah.
And then it's all through.
Yeah. We were really ghetto. But that's not a bad camera. It's basically like at that time, the two best digital cameras were that was the second best. And then the Cine Alta was the first, you know. And we couldn't afford that one. So all the best we could afford was the Varicam. And then I think I used Zeiss Super Speeds because I just needed all the light I could get. And then, you know, I wanted to shoot the movie on Super 16. I shot more film in college than I did video. I didn't even take really the video classes ever. So, but I mean, this is when HD was coming out and this is when it was starting to be a big deal. And this is when people were just learning to understand it and use it. And it was exciting. Even as a person who, even to this day, I still prefer film if I can. That was really an exciting time because it was like, oh, wow, like, it can get a shot, you know, like, this doesn't look like video, this is 24 frames per second, you know?
Are there any particular sequences that you're really proud of in the film that, you know, you just, like, love the way they turned out?
It's more about performance in that movie. I'm not really that proud of, I'm proud of what my crew did and what they went through to help me make that movie, because they were just amazing, like, amazing support. I mean, as far as from a cinematic standpoint, you know, I like some of the scenes with Melissa and the kids, particularly, like, there's a fight scene between her and her son. That's, like, one of my favorite scenes.
Two-thirds of the way through the movie.
Yeah. I like that one. And you know, some of the day interiors in the trailer are nice. But we didn't really get to do what we wanted on that movie. We were very rushed for time. I won't say the reasons why, but there was certain people rushing us on set that, you know, there was many scenes where we only had, like, the second we put up the monitor, they were like, let's shoot. And then, as you know, with HD, you're lighting off the monitor, you're not really lighting with a light meter. And so we needed the monitor in order to light and see what we were getting. And a lot of the night exteriors, we were just like, as soon as the monitor went up, it's like, up. She's ready, let's go, you know, and it was just like, I was too young, I was a different person than I am now on that shoot, and I kind of was, I was letting people push me around, and like I wasn't ready, but I wanted to please everyone, so I was like, okay, let's go. But now I know how to be more diplomatic in a way where it's like, you know, I pride myself on being a very fast DP on set, but I know, so I know when to, I know when it's good enough to stop. But still, like, you have to be able to, like, put up a couple lights, you know, and go. And we did, there was a couple scenarios. There's a couple scenes I can't watch in that movie because I'm just like, oh, my God, that looks muddy as shit. It looks terrible. So I was kind of upset that, in a way, that I'm glad that Frozen River was a calling card for me because it was so successful. And otherwise, people wouldn't have known I existed. But kind of, I'm not as happy as I could have been with what the work was. But it was a learning experience. And I think for that movie, it was, most of it was right for that movie, because what Courtney wanted was, she wanted the movie to feel like a documentary, and she was attracted to documentary footage on, that I had on my reel, and I agreed that the movie should feel realistic and feel like a documentary, and so I think we achieved that, and I think really at the end of the day, what the look needs to support this, it needs to further the story and make the story more compelling, and if feeling like that was more real, put people more on the edge of their seats when they're watching that movie, and made them more emotionally invested, then we did the right thing. It doesn't matter if I didn't get to make it look super pretty and, so, like, up to my standards.
No,
you know?
No, but it's 100%. I mean, you know, I mean, it's not, when I was asking, you know, is there something you're proud of, it was more about, it was less about the light, you know, the lighting or the beauty of the image, and more about, like, the sequence as you saw it.
Like, did we pull something off, kind
yeah.
of,
you
know, in
or,
the story?
Or just you see the story unfolding through a series of shots that are cut together, and you go, wow, I'm really emotionally drawn into that. And I think you answered that with the kids. And
yeah, the kids, and the scenes with the kids, and just as time, you know, she's getting more and more sucked into having to do the scene with the baby. Everybody, you know, some people hate that, some people love it, but where they leave the baby, that's a really emotional scene for me, too, because, you know, now if I were to watch it, especially as a mom, I'm like, you know, that it's, what was great about that movie was that it was so original, and it's hard to find a new story that hasn't been told yet, and that was a really kind of a story that hadn't been told yet, and it's like, so, you know, these people are smuggling their baby across the border, and then, you know, Melissa's playing this typical, like, prejudice, you know, not super smart, upstate, like, kind of, she thinks they have a bomb in their bag, so she just throws it out the car, you know, like, and it's a baby, you know, like, so we was trying to convince the audience of that, and also trying to convince the audience that the car was actually going to go through the ice. Those two things are very difficult, because A, we didn't really, most of the time, have a real baby, and B, the ice.
You didn't really throw a baby out?
We didn't really put a baby in a duffel bag.
I don't think I can continue on with this movie. I mean, just to find out that you faked that, I thought we were talking about genuine action in movies. And do you... I'm done with this. I'm done with this.
I'm leaving. No baby. No baby. What do you think this is? Is this artifice? Fucking sorry. I couldn't help it.
I mean, it's so obvious. But, you know, people who don't work in movies don't always realize that you're constantly putting in a fake doll or, like, trying to make it look real and shit, you know. But the baby, but also really the ice thing, actually, I would say I'm kind of proud of. If people bought that, like, and I remember watching Frozen River in Eccles Theater at Sundance, where it was, like, you know, seats 1,600 people, and it was a packed theater, and hearing everybody gasp when the car seemed to go through the ice. And truth be told, we only spent one real day shooting on the ice, on the actual ice.
You spent one day shooting
on the
ice?
Yeah, I know, it's
going to
really upset you. We only spent one day out of the whole 24.
No, it doesn't upset me at all. It's amazing. I love hearing this.
The challenge, this was the first time I was really up with the challenge of, like, cheating locations. And so we were cheating all sorts of, we were coming up with anything we could to cheat that they were driving on the ice because it was a safety issue and we didn't have the money for it.
There are some shots where you see the car driving and it's obviously driven through a shoveled, plowed area. Snow banks on either side.
Like there was snowy fields, like farmland. We did a lot of stuff on farmland that we were pretending like that was the river.
Right.
We
did
it's clear
for the next line of trees.
Yeah. We did an airport, like runway. That was the river. We did mostly fields and airports, and then we did Lake Champlain. And then when we had to do scenes where you know, Melissa and Misty were talking to each other in the car, but it looked outside of the window, outside either window, it looked like they were on an expanse of ice and on water. That was something actually that I'm pretty proud of that I came up with, which was that we didn't really know how we were going to shoot those scenes because we couldn't get, we knew we could see out the window. There wasn't enough, the depth of field wasn't shallow enough that we could really cheat it. And we're like, oh, well, we could try to drive through a snowy field, but it's like not the best for, you know, handheld in a car. And there was just all these things. So there was a little beach that was in that area. There was like a little beach that actually went off into, you know, I think it went, maybe it was part of Lake Champlain, but wherever it was, there was water all in one side. So I was like, okay, so when we shoot Misty, we drive along and I look straight out at the water and we turn, flip the car around.
The shot where she's got the gun in her hand.
Mm-hmm. Any shots that they're inside the car and they're crossing the river, we shot. It was this tiny little stretch of beach and we just drove one way, and then we turned the car around, or drove the other way, turned the car around, drove the other way, and it was just like, you just have to get creative. I mean, it's pretty obvious when you think about it, but we needed a place where we could look, get close enough to the water to look like it's water.
Yeah, but even though it's supposed to be frozen, it didn't matter because it was just that image of water was enough to fool the eye.
It was frozen.
Oh, it was frozen.
It was frozen beach, but like, and I was like, why don't we just drive along the very close as we can get to it.
Well, that's
beach.
Innovation right there. That's innovation. That's using the tools that you have. That's, you know, that's fabulous that you did.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. We just had to get to think outside the box. It was like when they told me we weren't going to be able to shoot, we were only going to be able to shoot on the ice one day, I was really disappointed.
And the name of the movie is Frozen River.
Yeah, I was like, but we couldn't afford the ice scientist for more than one day or something. I mean, we were a low budget movie, so.
Yeah. No. So this is a lesson in how to tell a story, you know, passionately, how to get a story told. When you're working with whatever you can. So this leads, was it because of this movie that you got the call to do Magic of Belle Isle?
I don't know. I'm sure that there was a factor because at that point, Frozen River was like one of the only movies, that was like the only movie I'd done that anyone had really seen. I'd had some more stuff at Sundance, but you know, it wasn't released yet. Everything was kind of getting delayed for each movie had its own reason. Even though it got bought, it was having a delayed release. So when I got Magic of Belle Isle, I think what actually ended up happening in the end was that the line producer on that movie suggested, when they decided they were shooting in New York area, I think Rob and his longtime producer, Alan Greisman, were, you know, basically asking their line producer, you know, who do you suggest? What DPs? Give us the five top indie DPs who know how to get a movie done in 25 days. And Jared Goldman, who's the line producer, I think threw my name into the hat, and I had never worked with him at that point. But I was lucky he did that because he threw my name into the hat, and then I got a call from my agent like, "Hey, they want you to meet on this Morgan Freeman, Rob Reiner movie." And I was like, "What the fuck?"
No, like, I don't think you understand. I'm the one you get to shoot the low budget movie, not the one you get to shoot the Rob Reiner movie.
Yeah. And they were like, "It's Rob's most low budget movie," and so blah blah blah. He wants to meet, and I was just excited. And that's an example of I was scared to do this. Probably was going to be my most intimidating interview of my life, but I was like, If I've been called into this interview, then I belong there for some reason. So I went to the, you know, I think that they had heard of Frozen River, or they had seen it, actually, because when I went to the interview, Rob said that he had seen Frozen River and he really loved it. And I think in the end, probably what one of their deciding factors was, or one of the, you know, things that made them have faith in me to do it was that when they said, oh, how do you feel about a 25-day schedule? And I was like, I had just shot three features that were like, back-to-back that were 18 days apiece. And I was like, 25 days? I was like, that's easy. I was like, that's luxurious. So they were like, and they're like, do you know the Alexa? And I was like, yeah, I just shot a couple features. I had already shot, Shut Up and Play the Hits.
We're going to get to that in a second.
Yeah, so I knew the Alexa already, and I was comfortable with it, and I was like, yeah. I was like, I could shoot Alexa. Alexa's great. And I went on and on about how Alexa was great, even though in my heart I love film. But I was like, yeah.
Well, when you get the question,
How do you feel about the Alexa in the meeting? This goes back to your earlier point. You know, do you know how to light a green screen? I love the Alexa.
Yeah.
In fact, if I could shoot on anything right now, it would be the Alexa. Happens to be it's a wonderful camera.
It is a wonderful camera. If I don't shoot film, then I often, you know, the go-to camera for me is the Alexa. So
just on the technical geek outside, which doesn't matter for anything. Have you shot Red? Have you shot these other things?
Yeah, I shot Red. I shot a feature on the Red. It was called Free Samples. But... you know, we were just such a low-budget movie. It was really the best option we had at the time. And I like the Red. It's fine. I prefer the Alexa.
Yeah.
You know, I just like the color, the tones, and the workflow and all these things all better. Things.
But anyway, so that was just a side point. So you're in the meeting. You're talking about this. He's asking you, you know, you like this camera? Yes, I like this camera. 25 days. 25 days sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I was, like, totally into it. And I mean, I was being genuine. I wasn't lying. I did like the... I was just, you know, I was like, you're in a meeting with Rob Reiner right now to shoot a Morgan Freeman movie. You don't sit there and say, I'd rather shoot film. No, you say, I like the Alexa.
Yeah, right.
You know, you want the job, then you should be agreeable. When you get the job, that's when you could start to throw maybe some other, you know, ideas into the pot.
So what other things did Mr. Reiner want to know from you?
Yeah, he just asked, you know, he asked about Frozen River. He asked about my experience with the Alexa. He asked how I felt about, we talked about the lighting, the way I felt that his script should be shot. I showed him a bunch of photographs.
So you'd already read the script. You got the script. You're coming to meet on the movie. It wasn't a blind meeting.
No. I'd read the script and I prepared a whole bunch of photos and stills that I thought were representative of what I thought the movie should look like.
How did you get those photos and stills? iStock photo?
I just go online. I mean, I actually go online and, like, I've always collected images of actually, like, some famous photographers, some not-so-famous photographers, some just photographers that are not-so-famous, I think, do great work, or stills from movies, things like that. And I just have, like, a whole bunch of files and folders just filled with... And I sometimes accumulate them to just for a particular movie.
Right.
Like, I'll look for something in particular.
Uh-huh.
Like, Flickr is a great resource, actually. Yeah. But, you know, so with him, I went out on a limb, and I was like, you know what? I was like, I know Rob Reiner movies have a way that they look, you know, like, Rob's movies, they're all a little bit different. But, like, you know, they're a little more commercial than what I do. So I kind of had a combination of some commercial, more commercial-looking stuff, but, like, the lighting was a little bit more dramatic in the stills. And I was like, there's a little more contrast than I think I'd seen in a lot of his movies. And I'd seen all his movies. So I said, you know, I sort of preface certain shots with, you know, this might be a little contrastier than what you want. And, of course, that could be, you know, maybe we do something a little different. And, you know, I like that contrast. I love that contrast. I love how dark that is. So it seemed to me that Rob was open to maybe doing, I'm sure, you know, things mostly his way, but maybe letting the lighting get a little more daring.
A little more daring. So, I mean, well, first of all, A Few Good Men, pretty contrast.
Yeah, that's definitely. Movie.
Obviously, The Princess Bride is a completely different style than that.
And, yeah.
I mean, well, you can name 5 Rob Reiner films that are all completely different. But what was the approach you wanted to take what did you want the movie to look like? Sum it up as far as your just the overall look.
Well, I mean, I think I wanted to, and knowing we were going to shoot on Alexa, I think I wanted to have like a painterly look and look. I just wanted to make it look as filmic as possible, and I think I wanted it to be, you know, as far away from commercial as I could get it. In terms of, I knew it wasn't going to be a handheld, gritty, Frozen River style movie. It was going to be a movie that was on dolly. It was going to be a movie that was on sticks. It was going to be shot to camera. It was going to be shot over master. It was going to be very straightforward in terms of coverage, because it's more with Rob, it's about telling the story, and that's the way he likes to tell the story. So when you work with a director, you have to adapt to the way that they like to tell the story.
So what was his style in terms of your photography? I mean, like, did you have to...
Sorry, that was a perfect ending spot because I just ran out of cards.
you obviously have... It looked... The film, Magic of Belle Isle, it looked... Very bright, creamy, but it still had a lot of shadow where shadow could be.
Yeah, I mean, I think I played with it more in with Morgan and with Morgan's location. You know, it's like Morgan Freeman.
That house.
With men, honestly, like if you're making a commercial movie, you can't really fuck around with how women look because you want them, the idea is you want them to be beautiful and gorgeous and all these things. With men, there's less of like you have to make them look beautiful and gorgeous. It's more like you have to make them look, you know, dramatic, like make the shot beautiful. And, you know, if there's anything that looks weird on them, obviously if their skin can't take a certain type of light, then you want to soften it or, you know, do whatever you need to do. But Morgan's able to take really any type of light, and I realized very quickly, like, oh, I can light him super dramatically. So here's where I can do the drama, is in Dog Dave's house, you know, is with Morgan when he's alone with the dog and, like, things like that. And even when the little girl comes in, and even when Virginia came in, another scene where she came into his house, and I kind of kept it pretty, you know, was motivated, and I didn't, like, over, you know, I kind of let it be natural, and I think I felt a different responsibility on that movie than my other movies.
And as far as shooting with two cameras, see, Rob always shoots with two cameras.
Most scenes, I mean, all of our exterior scenes in that movie were, like, two camera, and all the interiors were mostly one camera because we couldn't fit the two. So there was, you know, the dinner scene when he goes over to the O'Neill's house for dinner. That was two camera because we just had to. So,
what was it like working with Morgan Freeman and, I mean, seeing him, you know, put on a show for your lens? Was it a completely unique experience that you'd ever had, or was it?
Yeah, it was thrilling. I mean, I had the pleasure of working with a lot of great actors. I mean, I got really lucky with Melissa Leo, obviously.
Yeah.
I don't even think I realized how lucky I was until I was on set with her, and I was like, this woman is for real.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's not fucking around.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but Morgan Freeman, it's like, he has this whole thing about him. It's like, he's a legend, basically a living legend, and you know, him coming on set, it's the same amount of awe that I had also working with Rob Reiner, whose movies I grew up on. And I mean, we watched religiously in our house. So it was like, to work with both of them, I wouldn't lie if I was, I mean, I was in awe of it, but, you know, very quickly, it's like, I don't get starstruck. It's like, you just get on set, and you maybe for the first second when you meet them, you're like, whoa. And then after that, you're working with them, like your coworkers. You're coming together as a team to get a job done, and you have to be, you know, professional about it. And then it's like, that's a person like me or you. But as far as Morgan's acting ability goes and watching him do what he does in front of the camera, I mean, there was many scenes where he would, I mean, at our table reading, before we were in shooting, I cried during the table reading when he was saying some of his monologues. He's that good.
Right.
I mean, he's so good. So it was an honor, you know. It was like, I felt like I was the luckiest person in the world. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Any particular scenes in that? Now, I know on Frozen River we were talking about, you know, you said there's things you cringe at. Things in Magic of Belle Isle that you look at and you go, oh, man, wow, I didn't think it would look that good, but it looks that good. Or it looks even better than I thought it would.
From the cinematography
wise.
I guess, you know, I love a lot of those scenes in his house with him just alone because I was able to get, you know, like I said, a little bit more creative. The O'Neill's house was brighter. It was all the girls. It was all the women in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was more even and bright lighting. And I tried to push it as far as I could. But Rob and Alan have the old Hollywood way of where we watch dailies at lunch. So we would go into this little room, me, Rob, and Alan, and Rob's wife, Michelle, and, like, Jared, the producer, and we would all sit down and watch, you know, Lori, the other producer, and we would watch the dailies and eat our lunch. And if there was any kind of commentary, you know, like, if somebody didn't look absolutely phenomenal, they'd be like, oh, look at her, you know, look at him, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's like, you know, I learned right basically after day one that I was like, I knew what I had to do. I kind of knew beforehand going into it that I knew, but anyway, I knew I would take it as far as I could in Morgan's house because it was a darker house. It had a different vibe. It wasn't like bright and cheery like the O'Neills. And so I would just, and also he's a depressed character. His character is depressed. So the emotional state that he's in for most of the movie is, you know, he's a drunkard who's trying, he's lost the love of his life and both the loves of his life. He doesn't write anymore. He doesn't have his wife anymore, and he is a drinker. So in my mind, I was like, okay, it could be very dark. It could be, you know, darker and sort of moodier in his world.
Right.
So those are the scenes I love the most in terms of cinematography, because I felt like I could do the lighting that I felt most passionate about mm-hmm. there.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a second about something completely different. Shut Up and Play the Hits. So one of the most revered, what do you call them, a group or a band? What would you call them? Band?
I mean, yeah, they're like a circus.
They're one of the most revered musical creators of the latter part of the 20th century, LCD Sound System. And you get to make this picture, this documentary. You're smiling at me.
No, it's funny because I hardly knew who they were when I started the job.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I'm sure that I had heard of them, but I hadn't heard their music. And maybe it's partially because I'm just not on the scene anymore.
You're not partying and just, you know.
I wasn't partying as much anymore. I have two kids. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I'm just kind of a homebody. And once I got approached about the project, immediately I was like, that sounds familiar. That name of that band sounds familiar. I'm like, who are these people? So then I like looked them up, and I was like, why don't I know about them? And then I started listening to their music, and I was like, damn. I was like, I love this music. I love their music. And I was like, why didn't I know about them sooner? And I think that I was out of the loop during that time period when they became huge. Yeah. And I was super lucky to get called to do it. And I think actually in many ways, like, I'm sure there's a million people that would be super fucking pissed to hear that I hardly knew who they were.
I think Scorsese said that before he made Raging Bull, he was not a boxing fan at all.
Right.
I think these things happen all the time. Your reaction was very, very funny. But this movie is, of your movies, if I may be so bold, this is my favorite one of your movies that you've worked on that I've seen. Because it's like pure photography and montage mixed, you know, with a documentary element and a concert element and a sense of photography and sound working together.
Yeah.
In a movie about a band playing there, and it's just a beautiful text. It's just an absolutely beautiful text to watch. And there are some photographs in there. How much of that was just you saying, I really want to follow him down the street. I really want to just get these candid moments. And how much of it was the producer saying, we want to make this movie and get like shoot for a week before they, or 2 weeks before.
The directors knew. Will and Dylan, the directors, very particular about what they want. Yeah. They knew what they wanted, but I think they also knew that like they could. There were certain shots that were very specific that they wanted, or moments. They were pretty specific about all the moments they wanted.
Tell us about the directors. How did they come to saying that, talking to the band and saying, we're going to make this?
You know, I'm not 100% clear on the story, but I do know it's something along the lines of either they approached James to say, hey, we made this documentary on Blur. They made this documentary called No Distance Left to Run. And they, I think, saw an opportunity, or they heard that the band, that LCD was going to play their last show, and they were like, we got to cover this, you know?
Right.
So I think they may have approached him, and then they all kind of got together on it. And James Murphy is actually very in tune with, he has a very cinematic eye. But these directors have a pretty amazing eye. Like, they're having the overhead shots and things like that, and combining the overhead shots with the exterior and then the overhead shots in the concert, you know, that's their brainchild. Like, that was things that they, there were definitely certain connections that they wanted to make that they knew about beforehand. And they're really clever that way, and that's why I love working with them. But I think they called, you know, they approached me about doing it. It was because they knew that I had shared a similar aesthetic, and so that I would probably bring similar ideas to the table. And, you know, if they told me to do something, they just told me to capture a moment, I might choose the way that they would be most pleased with, you know.
How much of it was freewheeling, run and gun, you with a camera over your shoulder and two people, and how much of it was actually like, let's sit down and talk?
All of it was like pretty much free run and gun. I mean, they, like, the directors and I would like talk about what the scene was, what was going to happen, and then we would say, you know, sometimes it was very general, like, he's just going to be over here doing this, and then you're going to kind of follow him. But they gave me sort of instruction, sort of general instructions for the whole movie, which was basically the type of handheld they wanted, the type of shots that they wanted, in a very general terms. So if you, when we started shooting backstage at the concert and stuff, they were like, you know, find moments. You can find whatever moments you want. Like, they weren't directing as I was shooting. They were basically like, but pick something and stay there. Pick a very compelling shot that you can find, but don't feel the need, if someone off screen is talking, to pan over to that person. So that was their direction, and I think it was really, really good, because it, you know, it's like every director is different, and they want something different. Some people want you to get everything. Some people want you to do what they're doing, you know, and
well,
so...
Well, that's interesting, because that's, I think, that aesthetic that you just commented on is probably what underpins the non-concert action of the movie.
Yeah, you know? That's what I loved
about it. You just feel like you're being exclusively... You feel as though you're being given a window into something, but not a panorama, a window, mm-hmm. you know, and that's okay. That, you know, that we're seeing... You can't see everything, so you see part of it.
Yeah.
Things that are interesting.
I mean, that's what that's actually a way of shooting that I love. You don't know if you can normally get away with that. I needed them to tell me that it was okay to do that. That was the information. That was really all the information I needed, actually. They were like, you could shoot whatever you want, that, you know, like in general, like with the concert and stuff, but pick something and stick with it for a little while, you know? And, so I needed that much information, and they gave me that much information. And then when we actually did the scenes, you know, at the concert, we had 10 Alexas. We had each operator was their
Sorry,
own.
Al's frothing at the mouth over there. Yeah.
It was like every Alexa in New York was on this concert. But I didn't have, you know, the concert, what was brilliant, what the directors did was, and obviously this was their idea, because I came into it kind of, I came into it as the person who was, originally we were going to shoot a whole bigger non-concert section and make it separate from the concert. But they ended up combining it, which I think was the best way to go. And they were like, you're going to shoot everything to do with James at the concert, you know, everything to do, you're going to follow James backstage basically everywhere and follow James onto stage and all these, you know, but you could kind of go wherever you want, you know, just.
So were you hand-holding?
Yeah. It was like a 15-hour, 16-hour day of hand-holding the Alexa. And I didn't have... I noticed a lot of these other DPs who were operated... The brilliant DPs operated on this concert. That's why the concert looks so great. It's because the directors wanted each operator not just be an operator. They wanted DPs who were like... And they basically, the direction they gave the DPs, they gave all of us, was don't shoot it like it's a concert. Don't shoot concert shots. Shoot... Make us feel... shoot it as if you're at the concert, like as if you're a person enjoying the concert, that kind of thing. So because the directors did that, I think it motivated everybody to be like, oh yeah, I can get a little artistic with this. I can do something outside the box.
A little
I don't
bit
have
of aperture.
Yeah. Some of the shots were set. Like there's definitely like a wide shot from way back that, and the DPs were all rotating, and some were, the two people that were kind of roving the whole time were me and Spike Jonze. And I didn't even know he was going to be operating on the concert till I got there and saw him.
Spike Jonze?
Yeah, Spike Jonze is friends with James Murphy. So I guess he just wanted to shoot the concert because he just thought
Spike
it'd be fun.
Spike was holding a camera.
Yeah, he had an Alexa too. So he and I were the ones who were...
Okay.
Yeah. When I got there, I was like...
Hey, what's your name again? Yeah, Spike Jonze. Oh, yeah, you're the guy that made some of the best movies in the past few years. Okay. Cool.
It was really funny because I didn't know that he was going to be there, because I didn't really, you know, I just go with the flow with these directors. I was just like, all right, you bring me to concert. I'm just going to shoot everything I could shoot from way pre-concert. As they're building the stage, I started shooting. I mean, none of the other cameras were operating at that point. I basically started the stage build, all that stuff, straight through to the after party till 3 a.m. So, it was a long day. But what happened was when I realized... I first noticed Spike holding a camera, and I was like, I turned to the director, and one of the directors, and I was like, is that Spike Jonze? And they're like, oh yeah. I'm like, no big deal. I'm like, you could have told me that, like, he was sort of awkward. Like, we're getting in each other's shots. Like, this is awkward. Like, hey, how you doing? So I was psyched, though, and it was really cool. But, like, the other DPs that were there are brilliant. They were amazing. Best, like, amazing Steadicam operator. The Steadicam op from Black Swan was in the front row. And most of those DPs just would rotate. They would go from section to section, and they would rotate. But nobody was on a walkie telling them what to do. So everybody was really just following their own instincts.
Really?
While certain shots were set. Like I said, the wide shot didn't really change. But, like, whoever was in the wide shot probably rotated to a different camera at a certain point and was able to do other things. But the roving handhelds were me and Spike. So we were able to kind of go wherever we wanted. And I think the other director, one of the directors, Dylan, also would rove around from time to time. Or he was actually in a position. He was handheld, but, like, in a set position on the stage.
Spike hack it the whole day? Could he hack it? Or did he gas out?
No, I think he could hack it. I mean, they were just...
Could he hack it as well as you?
Oh, yeah.
If you and Spike Jones got into a boxing match, who would win?
Probably he would. I mean...
Really?
I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover.
You're a lover?
Yeah. Okay. But I could do a good... I'm good at arm wrestling.
So if you think you could beat him in an arm wrestling match?
I don't know. I haven't seen his arms. Oh, he's wearing a sweatshirt, so...
I think he's pretty skinny. I'm pretty sure he's pretty skinny. Like, he doesn't have much... And it's all about the lats, too. I understand it's, like, more in the lats.
Yeah.
So, for the...
If you do a lot of hand... I'll tell you what. Handheld, like...
Yeah.
200 days out of the year, you know, so if you do a lot of handheld, I think you get really strong in your back. You don't really get strong anywhere else. I mean, you get a little bit strong in your legs, but you're mostly like, I'm not athletic at all. I don't exercise at all.
Right.
Once I had kids, I stopped exercise of all kinds.
Yeah.
The only exercise.
I exercise all the time.
Yeah.
You'd probably tell by looking at me, I'm in pretty good shape.
I'm just
trainer. Yeah. He's my trainer. No, but you, but just to be clear, you, Spike Jones, arm wrestle, who would win?
I don't know. Maybe we can do it sometime and find out.
Okay, fine. We'll set it up. Yeah.
I'll be, like, training hardcore. It's the handheld. The handheld helps. But it was good. It was good. I actually ripped. It's funny. I actually got a blister on my shoulder because men don't have this problem when they do handheld because they don't wear bras. So, I mean, I had a bra strap. I'm stupidly.
Speak for yourself, Reed. Okay? Speak for yourself. How do you know I'm not wearing a bra right now? How do you know?
I don't know. I mean.
How do you know I'm not wearing a bra right now?
I don't know. I mean, you. I was kind of thinking that you probably... I wasn't really thinking about it, actually.
Yeah, well, maybe you should. Anyway, no.
All
right, so you're shooting this film, and then it's one big 16-hour day.
It was crazy, yeah, and then we shot before and after.
After,
a bunch of scenes, and those scenes where the directors were pretty solid about what they wanted. They knew what they wanted James to do, and then I would just find an angle and be like, hey, guys, you like this? Sometimes they would have an angle in mind.
There's one clip on YouTube. Of you following James down.
That's not me.
Oh, that's not you.
No. That's another... I went to Austria to shoot a movie in Austria, a feature, and they had to come back and shoot some just sort of, like, insert-y, like, B-roll stuff that we couldn't get when they were there the first time because we were always going to do a second shoot. But when they came back for the second shoot, it was, like, 3 or 4 days of shooting, and I wasn't available. I had to go to Austria, and I was like, just, you know... So they brought their other DP... So I don't actually know how that went down, but I would imagine that the directors had that idea because they're clever like that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, to put him out of focus and then keep the, you know, and just keep following and following him. So that actually, that brilliant shot wasn't me. I hate to not take that.
Tell us about some of your upcoming... it is a brilliant shot, but that's okay. Tell us about some of your upcoming pictures that you are excited about. Some things that have yet to be released.
Kill Your Darlings it's a movie, a period piece, my first period piece about beat poets and kind of a murder that they were all wrapped up in, Kerouac and Ginsberg and Burroughs. So that movie we shot last March, and it's pretty much at Lock Picture right now. So, I mean, I think their goal is they're going to try to get it into the festival circuit in early 2013, and you know, it's amazing cast, you know, just like an all-star cast. Daniel Radcliffe is Ginsberg.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
It's amazing. James Franco played Ginsberg.
Yeah.
In the movie about Ginsberg, and now Daniel Radcliffe's playing Ginsberg.
Yeah.
I think everyone's playing Ginsberg these days.
Do you know that Allen Ginsberg operating the camera? No. Anyway, next time.
Yeah, so that's the that one's pretty interesting because, you know, we didn't have, you know, most of the movies, a lot of the movies I shoot are on 35. That movie we shot, we're able to shoot on 35. And
great.
We shot, you know, the style of the movie is interesting. It's definitely not, I think it would be safe to say it's not like any movie you've seen before.
Right.
So I'm really excited about that one. And then,
very cool.
It was very fun to shoot. You know, Ben Foster was Burroughs. And,
he is a powerhouse.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
He's so good. And then, you know, we had Michael C. Hall playing David Kammerer, who
talking about a trio of huge actors here.
Yeah.
Tremendously powerful.
Do you watch Boardwalk Empire?
Yeah.
The, you know, Jack Houston, who plays the guy with the mask.
Yeah.
He played Jack Kerouac in the
movie. Oh, really?
We had Jennifer Jason Leigh. We had Kira Sedgwick, Elizabeth Olsen.
Who directed the picture?
This guy, John Krokitis.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a very unique director. He's very close to my heart. We're really, really, really close. Like, I really love him. And I say unique in a... You know, I would say that to his face. He's not like any director I've ever worked with. He's crazy. He's batshit crazy. But in a good way. He's really inspiring. And he's so much fun to work with. And he has some unorthodox tactics, directorial techniques, but he gets what he wants.
Shoot an actor in the face or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
He's great. And the movie is just definitely like a sort of a spectacle, and it was low budget for what it was, so it'll be interesting to see how people react to it.
Awesome. Anything else that
hasn't come out? I did this movie called Autumn Blood, which is very weird, kind of allegory, almost like a modern-day fable about a brother and a sister who lose their parents, and they're living on this alm in the mountains, in the Alps, and there's some sort of basically really shady people that live in the town that's nearest to them, and they just get wrapped up into, they get wrapped up in a scenario where they're basically being hunted. And there's almost no dialogue in the movie, which is what attracted me to it. At first, I was like, okay, well, shooting in the Alps, that's pretty awesome. We're going to shoot film, 35 and 65 millimeter, and it's...
65.
We shot some 65 on it, which was pretty awesome.
And I would think that's pretty, yeah. I mean, so
cable cam shots, you know, we even did a shot where we hooked up.
Was this a panty 65, or was it...
No, we worked, Ari Munich was sort of co-producing the movie, so we were able to get some, all our gear was from Ari. And
whose lenses were you using?
On that movie, I think I used Cook S4s. I pretty much always use Cooks unless I'm, like, can't afford them.
Uh-huh. And what about to cover the... Cover the
65. Oh, for the 65, yeah. It was the I think Ari has some 65 or maybe
specialty built
lenses that only open to a T4. And,
That must have, what did that, when you saw that stuff projected or even daily, it was just like
we didn't see the dailies until way after the movie was done for the 65 because the 65 machine was broken. It's just like a whole bunch of shenanigans going on over there. We're like,
oh, those Germans are so disorganized.
Yeah,
their engineering is such crap, you know.
It was cool though. It was a cool experience, and it looked beautiful. And looking through a viewfinder of a 65 millimeter camera is one of the most thrilling things that's ever happened to me because it's like when you put your eye up to that viewfinder, you actually feel like you're in a movie theater. Because it's so, what you're seeing inside the viewfinder is so much bigger than what you're used to seeing in a regular 35 viewfinder.
Right.
And it looks almost, you almost feel like you're like in a little movie theater.
You're falling into it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And like the, we were able to do some really cool shots on that movie. A lot of mountain climb, like a lot of hanging off the side of the highest waterfall in Tyrol, like while shooting and just things I had never done before, but it really, like, made me more well-rounded as a shooter. And we even hooked up our Steadicam guy to a cable cam and did this whole shot that was, like, basically overhead of our lead character, the girl, basically following her as a bird's-eye view. And then eventually eventually the cable cam comes down and we unhook the Steadicam and he seamlessly starts following her through the trees. So the whole shot just starts way, 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 way high up in the air and then comes down and eventually starts falling. And then so that the idea was we wanted to be with her, almost like a god's eye view, kind of, and then just be eerily following her. But also what's cool about the shot is that it's one of those shots where you would be like, how would they do that? Because it starts up super high, and then it starts, like, really... Then it becomes super close to her and weaving in and out of, like, trees and foliage and things like that. And so we got to do some fun stuff on that.
What's the name of the picture again?
It's called Autumn Blood. It's not a horror film. It just sounds like it is. No. But it's... and then... So that one, I don't know. Hopefully people will see it. And it's not for everyone. It's definitely a weird movie. And then I did this movie called The Inevitable Defeat of Mr. and Pete with George Tillman, who directed Soul Food.
Yep.
We had Jennifer Hudson in it, and Anthony Mackie, and Jeffrey Wright.
Anthony Mackie, one of the great actors of our Jeffrey Wright.
They're both. All three of them were, like, phenomenal. But the main characters, actually, in the movie, the real main characters are these two kids, 9 years old and 13 years old. This kid, Skylin Brooks, is the 13-year-old. He plays Mister, and he's just the most incredible actor, child actor I've ever worked with.
What's his name?
Skylin Brooks. He has, like, more nuance in a single look than, like, I've seen in a lot of, like... old actors who've had years and years and years of experience. But he was, I definitely, like, I get very involved in a scene when I'm shooting it, and there's been times where I've, you know, where I've teared up in the viewfinder, and if you're shooting film, you can't pull your eye away, and then your viewfinder fogs up, and you're fucked. So you just keep shooting the scene, even though you can't see it.
There's that famous shot of a close-up of Ellen Burstyn in Requiem for a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And on the, I think it's on the behind the scenes that Darren Aronofsky mentions that the framing was, you know, instead of here, it started to get like here or something off a bit. And at the end of the show, the performance was, and he turned to Matt and said, "Matty, what happened?" The eyepiece is like, "I'm sorry, I couldn't see."
You're crying, and then it just fogs up, and you can't see anything. You just got to go on instinct. That's happened to me before on, you know, and on Mr. and Pete. There was a scene between Jennifer Hudson and Skylin Brooks, and they play mother and son in the movie, and this never happened to me before, but I literally was, as I was shooting, tears were streaming down my cheeks. Super embarrassing. Nobody saw it, but everybody, then I, like, after, it was a closed set anyway, and there was only a few of us in there, and after we cut, I noticed that everybody was affected similarly.
That's when you turned up, you said, "Who spilled their drink on me?" Well, these are all, we're all looking forward to seeing all these pictures and seeing more from Reed Morano. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And without wanting to get too personal or too, presumptuous, for what it's worth, I'm sure your father is very proud of you.
Thank you.
Cool. Now I'll just do the introduction that I never did at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So, in the world of cinematography, welcome back to Craft Truck, Through the Lens. We're very lucky today to have with us somebody who has shot straight up through the ranks through sheer innovation, talent, and diligence. Somebody who shows tremendous, tremendous ability and a real... amazing personality, a new face to cinematography that's going to make beautiful pictures for years to come, Reed Morano. I like to make him really, like, downplay.
That's really grandiose.
I like to downplay.
That's why he saves them for the end.
That's it.
So he embarrasses you.
Yeah, that's good.
That's it.
Thanks.
Back, you're just so intense and, like, so difficult.
I am. You should see me on set, Rob and Ellen. They dubbed me my nickname Reed 2.0 because I seem all nice and sweet in the interview, and then on set it's like I'm dropping F bombs and saying, like, super offensive shit, and like
you should say super offensive shit, like, here.
I don't know, because I usually reserve that for, like, a surprise. Once people start working with me, they get to see Reed 2.0, and they're like, "Oh wow, I hired a trucker to shoot my movie instead of
like a sweetheart.
This sweet, like, innocent, nice girl, you know, like."
Oh, you don't come across as innocent. You don't come across as innocent. There's no naivete there.
Not like a mom, like a boring mom.
No, you do not come across. No. I, I'm, I just had my first child, and my wife.
Congratulations.
Is a boring mom either. No. I don't see moms. I never saw moms that way, but whatever. Anyway, so it's because my mom is like, she's fucking tough.
Yeah. My mom tough fucking, as nails.
She'll fucking kick my ass, man. No. But
she did a good job with you.
Sorry, I had to snicker.
I'm sending that to her.
You just made a Jewish woman's day.
From one Jewish woman to
another. Yeah, yeah. I was gonna say. I hope I made
you. You should be very proud of your son.
I told you, Ma. Anyway, so anyway, no, a couple things. Before I ask you this, I should tell you, the first job I ever had when I was 19, and I went to Interlochen. I don't know, like, mm-hmm. Maybe some of your contemporaries went to this at NYU, whatever. And so I got a job in Toronto working with this guy who made a documentary in the 60s that was amazing. The late 60s, early 70s, called Breathing Together, Revolution of the Electric Family.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's seen this movie. It went to Cannes. It was in a certain regard at Cannes. And it's got... It was shot all by him, 16mm Bolex and some modified shit. He's a brilliant guy. He was an engineer. He's an industrial designer. And he shot Jerry Hoff, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, William Kunstler,
mm-hmm.
Fred Hampton, and he has Ginsberg. Tons and tons of Ginsberg footage.
Cool.
16mm black and white. He has Ginsberg sitting there oming and playing like the accordion for like an hour.
Wow.
So if you want, I can try and dig up that footage and get it for you.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I think you'll like it.
I would love to see it.
I think you'll like it. But it's all the Chicago 7. It's all the Chicago 7. Yeah. It's about the Chicago 7. So. Yeah.
That's pretty dope.
Yeah, it's dope. It's dope shit. Anyway, so, okay, three names. Audio Rorschach. I give the name. You just tell me your thoughts on them.
Okay.
You know, it could be on their work, on them as people, anything. Whatever honestly comes to mind. It could be on their movies. If you want to mention specific movies, that's great too. This sequence and this scene and that, this shot and that, whatever. The late, recently passed, Harris Avedis.
Oh, yeah, that was really upsetting. Just the other day, yeah. He's pretty brilliant, pretty big inspiration, I know, to me and a lot of the cinematographers of my generation. You know, my favorite thing that he did was Elephant, and the way that was shot, and, you know, his work with Gus Van Sant is pretty phenomenal. I mean, all his work, it's the kind of, you know, he's amazing. He was amazing. It's heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah. Roger Deakins.
Love Roger Deakins. I mean, it's sort of like who you'd be crazy not to. I mean, I think his work and, you know, the kind of work that Harris does, that kind of style of lighting and you know, I think sometimes they're doing motivated lighting, sometimes they're not, but ultimately what it is it serves a story, but it's always beautiful, but doesn't draw attention to itself. It's like that kind of thing, it really attracts my eye and, you know, No Country for Old Men is like one of my favorite movies for cinematography.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just love it. It's almost like you can't even. It almost has film noir elements to it at certain points, which I really appreciate. So
the sequence where he's gone back to try and give the guy water.
Yeah.
And then the truck pulls up over at the top of the cliff.
Yes, it's so beautiful.
Yeah,
I'm a big admirer.
Mr. Gordon Willis.
Gordon Willis is phenomenal. I mean, that's his. What I love about, I think Gordon Willis's work is sort of what motivates me to do things darker and, you know, more on the edge. It's like it made it. When I would see his movies, it was more like it made it okay that you don't. I don't think there needs to be an eye light on an actor every single time. I think you should be able to see. You don't even always need to see their face. You can see I think there are times when you need to see their face and where you need to see be able to read the emotion, but it doesn't need to be like exact. I think there's a point where things need to feel not lit. And I think what he was the master of was making things not feel lit, but yet they were so phenomenally beautiful. And so for me, that's like a huge, that's a huge goal for me with images, where it's in a movie where it's appropriate to that, you know, like movies where I could do that, where I could take it to the limit and go to the, you know, go to the edge of darkness and like, you know, light one scene with just a bare bulb and, okay, this whole side of their face is dark and that's cool, you know. So he's definitely, he's yeah. like the master, you know.
One more name, just for fun.
Uh-huh.
Janusz Kaminski.
I love Janusz. I mean, like, not as huge, I mean, I don't know, I don't want to say I'm, like, not as huge of a fan, so don't, like, put that in. I'm more into, like, Conrad Hall's shit and, like, that kind of stuff, you know? But they're all so good. I mean, you can't...
Let's talk about Conrad Hall for a second, then. Conrad Hall.
Conrad Hall. He was always my favorite. My sort of, like, the person I always... Like, I loved American Beauty, and obviously everybody loves Road to Perdition, and he... combined that look, you know, he combined a more stylized look and compositionally very like photographic images. What I always noticed about the way he shot was that every frame could have been its own standalone photograph. And I mean, a lot of these cinematographers are like that. They're just so in tune with what is visually pleasing. And, you know, that's what I loved about Conrad Hall's work and his lighting and, you know, just the composition and the elements where he placed things in the frame. And there's a word I'm looking for. It's like when...
That's how you feel about Conrad Hall.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about him.
I got to meet him once before he passed away.
You did?
Yeah. It was a pretty big deal for me. I was still, like, just starting out, and he was at the ASC Clubhouse, and I went there for some kind of event, and, you know, all these young, nerdy, DP wannabe guys were, like, crowding around him, asking him all these questions, and they were saying, you know, what filter did you use on such and such scene in American Beauty, or, you know, and Conrad was kind of like, you know, I don't really remember what I did there. I don't really remember much of anything that I've done. I mean, in the moment, I just do what my gut tells me. I just go on my intuition, and then, you know, there's not necessarily a technical reason. It's more like I just go with a feeling. And when he said that, it made me realize, like, I could be a DP too, because I thought because I didn't know, because I wasn't super technical, I wasn't going to be good. And it's not about that. It's about, you should definitely know your shit, but it's like about being, it's about intuition. It's about knowing what's right in that moment. It's about knowing how far to take it. It's about, I mean, I like make all the decisions on my light readings. It's like I used to really bounce off ideas off of other people, you know, like my gaffer. And now it's just like I take the certain readings that I always take, and then I sort of say, you know what, I think I want to go here. And I do that because, and there is a rhyme or reason in my head, but it's not mathematical. I mean, it's like there are mathematical basis. There's a mathematical basis to it. But anyway, the point of it is that Conrad Hall made it okay for me to, it's like almost like what he said, it made it okay for me to try to do the job too. Because it meant like I don't have to be this super nerdy dude who knows how many foot candles this light throws at this distance. You know, it's like you don't need to know those things.
Right.
You just need to know, like, that's the right tool for the job because I've done this before and I know that that's going to do it. Or it's like in my mind I know how much throw a certain light has, but I don't know, like, the number of it. I just know that if I put it up on that roof over there, it's going to reach into that window. I know that that 20K will do that. I know that, you know, like, the 6K at that distance will do that. But anyway, Conrad sort of, like, gave me confidence, and also was, like, the biggest inspiration, so.
Fantastic. Thanks again.
Yeah, no problem.
That was awesome, man.